And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I don't like to complain, but at this point, I've got to complain to somebody, and it seems that nobody else is interested in listening. So, a little over a week ago, we left three dogs in tow and headed from Bainbridge Island down to Rancho Mirage. And it was to be a two-night, a three-day affair. And everything was going relatively well until we got to the Hilton Hotel, our second night stay. And we called ahead, and we were told that we didn't have a reservation. Well, my wife had the reservation right there. As a matter of fact, they'd even contacted us with an email saying, your room is ready. But the end result was, I think they had overbooked. And so we went ahead and drove the last 5 hours on into Rancho Mirage, which means I drove for, I guess, about 12 hours that day. No complaint there, but little did I know that that was the start of something that would get worse, because we got to the house, which we've spent almost no time in, and it seems like everywhere we turned, nothing was working the way that we thought. The TV didn't work the way that we thought it would. Many of the electrical outlets didn't work. And in fact, in one case, we would plug into an outlet and turn on the machine, and another machine down the wall would go on at the same time. So that was disconcerting. And then I had an interview with Doc G. That's Jordan was supposed to interview me at 8 in the morning, and the internet was down. Now that was, it was down for the whole neighborhood. So that was not, it wasn't the house. But there were so many things like this that were not working as expected. So here I am about to record the first podcast from my new office. And it's not a lovely office, but it's a clean office and does have a window so I can see the palm tree outside. And a whole wall of mirrors. So if I want to see how my hair looks, I can look in the mirror, and that's all quite nice. But now I actually have to go to work and talk about something that you're going to find of interest. And what I have of interest, at least to a group of people, are the questions that came out of the presentation that we made to the AAII New York City chapter on small cap value, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so we have almost 50 questions. I'm going to handle 12 of them in this podcast, and we'll get through the rest in the coming weeks. If you did not see that video, I hope you will watch it, because I think it probably is the best discussion regarding small cap value that that we have done. So let me get into these questions. The first question: curious to hear your thoughts on investing internationally. Would you still recommend using an index fund for international exposure? And I think the best answer to that question comes from the SPIVA report, S-P-I-V-A. It's updated every 6 months. It must have 50 pages of numbers that are absolutely marvelous to look through. And one of those pages is going to be devoted to international funds actively managed, and how many of the actively managed funds are able to achieve the benchmark. Remember, the benchmark is what we're going to get for, theoretically anyway, for an index, less whatever the expense is. But the key here is that the answer is the same for international funds, according to SPIVA research, as the U.S. funds. And that is about 1 out of 10 of the actively managed funds, actually a little fewer than that, but about 1 out of 10 are able to do better than the benchmark. And the bad news there is that the average of all of the internationally actively managed funds, the average return is about 2% less than the benchmark itself. So it is every bit as important, I think, to use the international index funds. And we have a small cap international value recommendation, small cap blend, a large cap value, large cap blend, and emerging markets under portfolios. Those are all part of the best in class ETF portfolios. I do want to add something though, because some people are uncomfortable having internationals, either because they haven't performed well over the last 10 or 20 years, or maybe it's just because it's outside of the U.S. market. But I think it's important, this table I'll make reference to a couple of times on this podcast, table H2, we'll have a link to that. In that table, it shows the results of the U.S. only four fund strategy, and that compound rate of return from 1970 to 2022 was 11.8%. If you built instead of the four asset classes in the U.S., those four asset classes would be large and small blend and large and small value. But if you did the same thing, but you used a combination of U.S. and international funds, it was 11.9. So there was 0.1% difference. And in fact, with the worldwide, we can't get to the exact index funds that we can for the U.S. only. So the numbers are not quite as exact, and so it could be that they both got 11.8. All I'm saying is what you're really after is not about U.S. versus international. It's about the right asset classes, the right amount of small cap value, small cap blend, large cap value, and large cap blend. It didn't matter whether you were globally balanced or just U.S. only, about the same return. And the ultimate buy and hold portfolio that goes beyond those four major asset classes and picks up REITs and emerging markets compounded at about 12. And I just can't help but mention that the two fund strategy, that would be the S&P 500 and small cap value, you see, that would have a bit more of the, obviously more of the U.S. value. It would not have any of the large cap value, but small and large value generally go up and down together. But that compound rate of return was 12.2. So they're all within a relatively small difference, given that's over a 53-year period. Question number two. Given the long periods that small cap value underperforms the S&P 500, should small cap value be avoided by those nearing retirement? And what that person is referring to is the telltale chart of the small cap value versus the S&P 500. And it looks at some very long periods of time. In fact, I think there were three periods of 17 to 19 years, that the return at the end of that period of time was about the same. Now, a lot of stuff happened in between the beginning and the end of those three periods. So here's what we know if we look at shorter periods of time. If we looked at all of the five-year periods, the 90-10, 90% S&P 500, and 10% small cap value did better than the S&P 500, 71% of the five-year periods. Looking at 10-year periods, again, 90% S&P 500, 10% small cap value, 83% of the time. If we go out 15 years, 94% of the time, and by the time you get out to 20 years, it's almost 100% of the time. And so that study would say, yeah, you're probably okay to have small cap value in your portfolio when you are nearing retirement and in retirement. But I also want to make note of another study that we used in our presentation, the video about small cap value. And that was the study that showed that the S&P 500 had 145 so-called lost decades between 1927 and 2023. 145. Now, these decades were 120-month consecutive where the return was negative for the over the long period. Now, if we looked at those same 145 lost decades, small cap value actually made money in 108 of them, and the average return for small cap value in those all of those 145 so-called lost decades, the average return for small cap value was a plus 6.45 versus a minus 2.33 for the S&P 500. So there is a different reason that you might want to own some small cap value, because small cap value oftentimes, in fact, more than most of the time, outperformed the S&P 500 in those terrible times. Question number three. What does an investor do if a small cap value index fund is not available in a 401k? And then they go on to ask, does small cap blend that is available have a similar impact as small cap value? Well, the bad news is that small cap blend, if we look back over the 1928 to 2022 period, small cap blend compounded at 13.7% versus the small cap value, believe it or not, at 16.2. Now, I'm going to be quick to say here that it is not my belief that it's going to compound at 16.2 in the future. Remember, for most of that period, nobody even knew what small cap value was. Today, we do, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But I want you to see that the compound rate of return for large cap value was 13.4. So the large cap value had almost as much of a premium as the small cap blend. But value, according to the experts, is a much stronger a factor in terms of premium, more dependable than the size factor. So in many cases, the only way somebody's going to get access to the small cap value is to do it within an IRA, although many folks I find don't realize that they have a right to self-direct investments within their 401k, and that if they go into the list of available funds that they can self-direct, that they will get access to a small cap value index fund. Number four, how can there be such radical differences between the different small cap value indexes? Now, this question was generated because I showed six different index returns for small cap value, for small cap blend, and small cap growth. And in most cases, in two out of the three, it was about a 2.5% difference from the best performer to the worst performer. And yet they are all indexes that are generally accepted as ways to invest in these different equity asset classes. Well, it does become complex because it can be from a matter of the difference in sizes. It could be with the difference in how deeply discounted the value is. The book to market, for example, can be much more value oriented in one over another. And in some cases, particularly for those that build their own indexes, they can focus on other factors that may have a bigger impact than one would expect. For example, Avantis Small Cap Value, they have a real sensitivity to trying to be in higher quality companies, companies whose finances are stronger or whose earnings are positive. And just briefly here, they segregate the strength of these companies partly based on what they call negative cash profitability. I'm not going to get into the details of that. If somebody's interested, email me, Paul, at paulmerriman.com, and I'll send you a link to some information that will be helpful. But in the case of AVUV, that's the Avantis Small Cap Value, less than 1% of the companies, 12 companies out of, I think they've got 700 companies, have what is called negative cash profitability. On the other hand, the Russell 2000 has some 470 companies that qualify for being in worse financial condition. The Russell 2000 value has 309 of these negative cash profitability companies. So there are ways that people who are building these, we'll call them indexes, we can call them passively managed, they are mechanically managed portfolios, but the way they slice and dice can be very different. And As you know, and I'll talk about this later, over the period of time since AVUV became public, it has way outperformed other of the small cap value portfolios because the market lined up with them. I mean, there was a period when VBR did better than the smaller companies. VBR, I think the average size small cap value company is about $6 billion. But during a period when larger companies and more growth-oriented companies were doing better, VBR benefited from that. And so there'll be periods that AVUV is not going to be top of the heap. Number five. Are you going to show risk-adjusted returns for the funds you are recommending? And then he has trainer ratio, sharp ratios, Sortino ratio. There's a number of different ways that you could risk adjust these returns. Now, we don't do that for the individual funds. Well, I guess we do for the S&P 500 and we do for small cap value because they are two of the nine so-called portfolios that we do track. But for all the other combinations, the four fund U.S., the global four fund, the five fund worldwide all value, the S&P 500 and small cap value, for all of those combinations, we have in fact done risk-adjusted returns along with the returns themselves. So if you will just look at table H2 at the bottom of the page there, you will see all of those combinations. And again, I think you'll see, particularly in the case of the Sortino ratio, that the combinations were a whale of a lot less risky unit of return per unit of risk than the S&P 500. It's one of the reasons we believe those portfolios are likely to be in your best interest. Number six, how does one juggle the choice between investing in a higher expense ratio ETF, and then in parentheses, say Avantis, compared to investing in a low expense ratio small cap value index fund? Would the decision be as simple as going with the lower expense ratio fund? Well, we can always look backwards and know what the answer would be, because as I've said a million times, there is no risk in the past. We always know what we should have done. But we do know that VBR has a very low expense ratio, 0.07, versus the Avantis small cap value at 0.25. Now, as I look at the difference in those two funds, a couple things stick out. One is the average size company with Vanguard's VBR is over $5 billion versus $2.3 billion for Avantis small cap value. So that's potentially a factor in favor of AVUV, because smaller is supposed to give a better long-term return. Then we look at the quality of the companies, and there we find that AVUV has a much, much higher quality portfolio. And that doesn't mean you're always going to get that premium, but certainly that is a premium that the people at Avantis feel is important to take into consideration. And we could also look at the number of securities and go with the fund that has greater diversification. But in the case of VBR and AVUV, they are about the same. So then we look at the returns. And I don't for one second believe that it's going to be this much different in the future. But over the period of time, since AVUV became available, we can compare exactly the return. And over that period of time, since September 30, 2019, AVUV up 57.6 versus VBR of 27.5. And so, obviously that's a huge difference over a relatively short period of time. I don't expect it would be that great over the decades. Number seven. Well, if everyone invests in small cap value, will that reduce the premium in the future? You know, that's a great question. Everybody knows about the premium for stocks over bonds. And we know if we go back to 1928 that there is about a 7%, 5 to 7%, depending on whether you've got short-term or longer-term, but 5 to 7% premium for equities over bonds. Now, that's a big deal. And the obvious question is, do we expect that to continue? It's not like it's an unknown. Now, what makes it questionable to some people is, for the last almost, 23 years, the S&P 500 has compounded at closer to 7% rather than 10. Does this represent something meaningful? Well, I don't know. And this is one of the challenges in investing in equity asset classes and factor investing. I would think that most would agree that the secret of small cap value has long been out of the bag. And yet, when we look at the returns, in fact, there's a wonderful table, B14B, that shows the difference between the S&P 500 and small cap value going back to 1970. And what you'll see is there's about a 3% premium for small cap value over the S&P 500, and it holds up relatively consistently over the entire period. Now, there are some periods when the S&P 500 is just killing small cap value, and other periods where small cap value is in control. Now, for my own planning and my hope for others, I have always hoped that there would be a 2% advantage. I also hoped the S&P 500 would make 10% and small cap value make 12%. But that's been for my own family planning. Number 8 is kind of more of the same, but at least worth bringing up, and that is, what is your reaction to investors who say the small cap premium is gone because private equity funds are now taking the small cap value firms private? I guess my answer is going to be that is certainly too early to know that is a permanent position by private equity. And these things, as we know, looking back to the returns of the S&P 500 versus small cap value, this is something that for very long periods of time, for whatever reason, small cap value is not where the big money's going. And then for reasons that we probably can't predict ahead of time, then there's a big rush for small cap value. So I don't see any reason why there should not be continued demand and availability for small cap value. Of course, you could also say that the problem is that now that small cap value is a recognized investment premium, potentially, that there's going to be a lot more demand for it, and that demand would force prices up and would, in theory, then lead to smaller premiums in the future. That's all certainly possible. The academics are very careful to deny what that premium might be that they know. They don't know. They just believe there will be one. Number 9, how do I rebalance annually with a 50% target date fund and 50% small cap value when they get rebalanced? So, pretty simple. The target date fund, all the rebalancing is going on inside of that fund. So there's nothing for you to do except to the extent that you want to rebalance with your small cap value. There would just be that that one decision. How much would come out of target date fund to go in small cap value, or how much would come out of small cap value to go into the target date fund? One of the topics for this year that I think Daryl is going to take on is the impact of rebalancing annually, biannually, maybe even as seldom as every 5 years. That should lead to higher rates of return. It will also expose investors to additional risk, but I look forward to seeing those numbers. Number 10, this is my favorite one, I think, because it gets to the bottom line of that presentation. The question says, on the small cap value, I caught the good and the bad. What was the ugly? Can you recap the three? Remember the focus on the good, the bad, and the ugly. So here's just a quick review. Good. The fact that small cap value has produced, depending on the time period you look at, a 3 to 6% better return than the S&P 500. Also good. Remember, I talked earlier in the podcast about the fact that over the 145 decade losses for the S&P 500, that small cap value in 108 of those actually made money, and that the average return, a positive return of 6.45% over all 145 periods that the S&P 500 lost money, the S&P lost 2.33. So there was almost a 7% difference for the small cap value on average over all 145 of those periods. Also good that by the time you get out to 5 years, small cap value is outperforming the S&P 500 over half of the time. And by the time you get out to 20 years, almost 100% of the time. And then from there, we have to move into the bad. And I think it is bad for investors that sometimes you have to wait 20 years before you get the premium that you expected. That is a real test. And it also is bad that the small cap value has suffered larger losses during the catastrophic period, especially the catastrophic period during the Depression and in the early parts of from 29 to 32. It was during that time that the S&P 500 fell over 80% and small cap value over 90. It is also interesting to note that starting in 1932 was the beginning of the best 40-year run that S&P 500 ever had. So that's the good news out of a really bad, bad market. And now the ugly. And I'm going to guess that very few people that follow our work are going to have anything to do with the ugly, because the ugly has to do with people who attempt or are forced to use an actively managed fund to access the small cap value asset class. And the reason it's ugly is because we know from the work of Spiva that I mentioned earlier, we know that the average actively managed small cap value fund makes about 2% less per year than the index itself. So that's the average. Now, that means, of course, some people were weren't as bad as 2%. Maybe, and we know also that a few, a very small group of managers, were able to do better than the index. And the really ugly situation is those small cap value managers who actively managed and made more than 2% less, could be 3 or even 4%. And of course that's a huge difference when you figure that people paid higher expenses and more taxes in those along with those that poorer performance, and it could have been so much better if they had just used the benchmarks themselves. And I love this question number 11. When starting out your career, did you always intuitively know that index funds are better, and especially the small cap value index? When did the realization dawn on you? Well, it dawned on me that, remember, I started in the business in 1966. There was no such thing as an index fund in 1966. Finally, there was in 1976, but there was no small cap value fund. I don't think there was a small cap value fund available until 1993, and it was in 93 or 94 that I was introduced to the work of Dr. Fama and Dr. French. So in a sense, you could say it took me almost 30 years to understand the implications both of indexing and of the use of small cap value. And finally, number 12. The investor says, Fidelity Freedom target date fund 2035 expense ratio is around 0.7. And then it has the word high with a question mark after it. Well, yes, it certainly is high. He asks, or she does, do two funds for life thoughts change for the Fidelity 401k? Well, it doesn't. I don't know whether you are stuck with the Fidelity Freedom target date fund with 70 basis point expense, or whether you have access also to the Fidelity Freedom Index target date fund that where the expense ratio is 0.12. So I'm hoping that you have the ability to make that change. By the way, the Vanguard 2035 target date fund has an expense ratio of 0.08. The reality is that expenses go on forever. They're guaranteed, unless, of course, they reduce them, which they most of them have over the years due to the cost cutting by Vanguard. But does that change the idea of two funds for life? It doesn't. I guess if I found somebody only had access to that very expensive Fidelity target date fund, I might encourage them to create their own target date fund. Remember what Fidelity is going to do. They're going to have X amount in equity and X amount in fixed income, and as you get older, they'll be adding more fixed income. Now, you could accomplish most of what they are going to accomplish if you simply used the S&P 500 that you could get from Fidelity, I hope, at a very, very low expense ratio. Then you would have to, as time passes, add the bonds to your portfolio, and you could use the glide path, the same glide path that Fidelity has, to create your do-it-yourself target date fund. This now leaves it open for you then to add, hopefully, a low-cost small-cap value fund to your portfolio. Now, my hope is that you will use a Roth or a regular IRA for the small-cap value so that you could take advantage of the AVUV, which I'm going to guess is not available within your 401k. I'm not sure if you're at Fidelity, you may have access to the self-directed end of Fidelity where you can pick and choose from any number of products to put into your portfolio. So I hope that helps. You all know how to get a hold of me. If it doesn't, at paul@paulmerriman.com. And I will continue forward on answering questions from that presentation on small cap value, the good, the bad, and the ugly. My hope is you will continue to pass this information along to others. I think the video itself would be a good thing to pass along to folks who you think are worthy of taking a little more risk in their portfolio. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing our information with others. And to those of you who are sending donations to our foundation, thank you for that. And we will talk to you next week.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.